And so big data for dating and writing menus for posh versus grotty restaurants. If you can crunch the DNA bits and the genomes, you can also crunch the words. Dan Jurafsky is a professor of linguistics and computer sciences at Stanford, and he's with Pauline Newman.
So you did a study of dating, speed dating, amongst college students. Tell me what you found.
Well, the most interesting thing we found was about the interaction between men and women. So you might imagine that men are sort of blustery and would talk a lot about themselves on these dates. And that's not what happened in dates that went well. If you think about speed dating, you know, you get men and women together in an evening and everybody dates everybody else for 4 minutes, have these little conversations. And at the end, if they like each other, they agree to exchange emails. And what we found is that men in general are not very picky in these speed dates. They sort of are willing to go on a date with almost anybody. And the women are much more picky. So in some sense, that makes the women the empowered party in these dates. They are the decider in these dates. And what we found is that the linguistics of the event were consistent with this kind of power structure. So dates in which both people said they clicked with each other, the men were more likely to be sympathetic. They would say things like, oh, that's terrible, if the woman was reporting a bad thing. They would interrupt, but only positively. They'd interrupt to say, oh, that happened to me too. So they would share excitement and agreement by telling similar stories. And dates that went well, the woman was more engaged. She wouldn't be robotic and monotonic. She would vary her pitch, and she would show these signs of engagement. She wouldn't use words like kind of or sort of, which are these hedges that indicate that you're kind of getting bored with the evening. So that suggests that in a good date, you really want to focus on the empowered party. In this kind of speed dating task, the woman is the empowered party. And it's nice to know that people were sensitive to this. People are very good language users, and they pick this up pretty quickly. And it shows that they're very sensitive to who's the decider.
And the women were saying I and talking about their own stories, weren't they? The men were just reflecting back what the women were saying. Very surprising.
Very surprising. And of course, methodologically, you could measure this just by counting the number of I's and U's. Even in the first minute, you can see something. If she uses more I's and me's and he uses more U's and yours, then the date's probably going well.
How many students were involved in the study?
There was about 1,000 dates. Let's see, there were 60 men, 60 women. And then together, three different evenings, each one with 20 men and 20 women dating. My colleague, Dan McFarland, he's a sociologist in the education department. He was interested in how people learn to present themselves. And normally when you run a study on a college campus, lots of experiments are done on college students, and you either pay them or you give them class credit. This was a case in which he was able to collect the data without paying anyone anything because they were so excited to be able to have a date as a result of the experiment. So in a sense, they gave their voice for science.
And you did another study, this time looking at food outlets and restaurants. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the dating study is interesting, but it requires that you get a whole bunch of people into a room. You've got to convince them to talk to each other and let you use their data. That's very hard to do. One of the advantages of the web now is that there's millions of words. You think of it as the fossils of linguistic behavior lying all over the web. And so we had this idea of trying to understand people just by looking at that language. So in this study, we looked at reviews. People just write reviews on the web all the time of all sorts of things. We looked at just under 1 million restaurant reviews of about 6,000 North American restaurants in big cities, and just asked what we could learn about people from these reviews. And we found a lot of unexpected things. So for example, the bad reviews. Once you give a restaurant a one star, you really don't like the restaurant. What do people say in those reviews? We thought, oh, they'll talk about the food. They'll say, oh, the food was greasy. Not true at all. They used a lot of negative words, like terrible and awful, and that's not surprising, but they used a lot of past tense, not the present tense, and they used the first person plural, the words like we and us and our. And it turns out there is a genre of language that uses exactly these linguistic characteristics, and it's the genre of people who are writing after they've been traumatized. Like a death, when Princess Diana died, her followers talking on the web, they would use exactly this kind of characteristic language. They would talk about it in the past tense as if to distance themselves from this bad thing that happened. And they would use the first person plural, the we and us and our, as if to say this bad thing happened, but we're going to get through it together. This bad thing happened to us as a group. And so we see this exact thing in these one-star reviews. So it's as if when people go into a restaurant and we looked at these one-star reviews, it's all the waiter was rude to me, they made me wait, they forced me to do these bad things, they disrespected me. So it's about the little disrespectful things that happen in day-to-day life that add up to some kind of a minor trauma, and we can see this trauma just in the words they used.
It's actually there a lesson for restaurateurs, isn't it? So if you serve bad food, you've got to treat the people nicely.
I think that's right. You could avoid the one-star reviews, at least, by just having friendlier staff.
And what about people who liked the food and gave good reviews?
When people liked a restaurant, we found a really interesting difference in how they talked about it. So if it was an expensive restaurant, they would use words like seductive and sexy, orgasmic. They talked about a naughty deep-fried pork belly. So all these words, seductive and sexy and orgasmic, they're referring to food in a sexual way. And that's not shocking. We all know there's some kind of overlap between the oral pleasures of food and sex. But it was interesting that that happens only with the expensive restaurants. There's something about an expensive restaurant that sex comes to mind. What we found in the inexpensive restaurants, by contrast, is they used the language of drugs. They said, I crave this food, or it's like crack, or like heroin, or I'm addicted to this chocolate. So there's something about these cheap foods, and it was foods like pizzas and French fries and cupcakes, so foods that you're feeling a little guilty about. And it's as if by talking about the foods as a drug, you're really shifting the agency from yourself to the food. I did this bad thing, but it's not my fault I did it. The drug forced me to do it. The cupcake made me eat it.
And you also looked at the menus themselves and found some interesting differences.
Absolutely. We looked at about 6,500 menus, looked at all the words in the menus, and asked questions about how this language differed according to the price of the restaurant. And we found very interesting differences. The cheaper the restaurant, the more likely they are to use the word you or your. And it turns out they were talking about choice, your way. Even just the use of the word or was more frequent in those restaurants. So they're the inexpensive diners and day-to-day restaurants are giving you a lot of choices. By contrast, the really expensive restaurants, they use words like chef's choice or chef's selection. They're talking about the chef a lot. So it's as if an expensive restaurant, the power is with the chef. It's really a theatrical performance by the chef for you. Whereas the cheap restaurants, it's really your day-to-day meal and what you want really matters.
And did you find that the words in the description, they varied in length?
We did. We found two interesting facts. One is that the more expensive the restaurant, the longer the words they tended to use. Unusual foreign words or very long words. For every extra letter in the average word, the price of that dish went up by 18 cents. And we found an interesting inverse relation with the number of words. So if you spend a lot of words talking about a dish, it's like crispy and flaky and fresh. You might think, oh, that's the expensive restaurants. They can afford to have crispy and flaky and fresh foods. But no, the expensive restaurants use very few words and none of those delicious adjectives in talking about the food. They have a very sparse, you might call it modest menu. It's the middle-priced restaurants, the big chains that are catering to families that use a lot of these words. And it's as if the expensive restaurants don't use them because they want you to believe the food is fresh. If they say it's fresh, then that's kind of bringing into question the whole freshness. Better to leave it unsaid and implied. And the cheap restaurants don't have enough something to go about even mentioning those adjectives. So you can figure out the price of the restaurant just by counting how many times they use the word fresh on the menu.
And when you're in a new city and you're wondering where to eat and you're looking at the menus on the outside, do you yourself pay much attention and sort of ignore the ones that say fresh?
You can totally use this information, and I do. I mean, I eat in all sorts of restaurants, and maybe linguists are kind of annoying dinner companions because I do spend a lot of time reading the words on the menu when I'm at dinner. But you do discover interesting things.
And why did you do this study?
Well, my first look at food actually came from a completely different study where I was looking at the etymology of words. So I was interested in the history of the word ketchup. I was living in China at the time, and everyone there knew that ketchup was a Chinese word. It sounds just like a Cantonese word. Jup is the Cantonese word for sauce. Ketchup sounds like it means tomato sauce. And so I got very interested in the history of food words, and I discovered, in fact, that ketchup is a Chinese word, that it came to America via a long roundabout way involving Indonesia and British sailors and the development of distilled spirits. And so that got me started thinking that really the language of food that's all around us has a lot more to tell us than just what we're eating.
And you've written a book about all this.
I have. It's called The Language of Food, A Linguist Reads the Menu. You know, I hear the author is really a great person and you should go read it.
Glad he liked it. The Language of Food, and that was the author Dan Jurevsky, Professor of Linguistics at Stanford University, with his hot date Pauline Newman. Next week in The Science Show, the start of Carl Smith's four-part series on our energy options. Yes, solar, wind, coal, waves, oil, you name it. Each program takes you there from batteries to geothermal. And also online, Wendy Zukerman's new pod, The Science Versus. This week it's The Female Brain. Production as ever by David Fisher and Andrei Shabanov. I'm Robin Williams.